Accession number 27083, wheel 2039.
So Henry, you were defending your tactics.
Yeah, this is the warship, yes. And this rather dreary, pompous man was saying, of course, it's absurd. Nobody would have done that under realistic conditions. And I said, on the contrary, I played exercises as if they were realistic. And that is what I would have done in war, and I would have got away with it. And he would not, and he was livid. And the admiral backed me up. He was tickled pink. So that was my initiation with Admiral Hayes. Well, then we went, we left Londonderry. We might have gone back to our base ports, I don't think we did. And we wended our way out to Gibraltar. We rendezvoused at a certain point, and we went out in company, and we exercised one way or another. The whole way. And the Admiral was very good, but he wasn't absolutely up to date with, shall I say, the latest sonar anti-submarine thinking. And he didn't really appreciate, I think, though I explained it to him later, and I'm not sure if he fully accepted it. He wasn't fully appreciative of the interference that sonars in adjacent ships on the screen operating on the same frequency might have in terms of interference and so on. And it was important to get this right. And he had, we joined up, of course, at Rosyth for the wash up after the previous Londonderry exercises, and got to know each other a bit. And he had warned me that on the way out there was a particular frigate which, in his opinion, I forget whether she'd been in the Londonderry exercise or not, it doesn't matter, but she was certainly going to be coming out to the Med with us. And this frigate had a fairly new and inexperienced commander who was an aviator as her captain, and he was inexperienced. It was his first command. He was a bit thin numerically on his officers, and they were a bit thin in terms of quality. That was my brief. Would I therefore please take particular care with him and look after him, and so forth, which I undertook to do. And I didn't know this chap at all. I got to know him well later. And in the course of the passage out, particularly one night, we were on a certain form of screen, and the Admiral made a signal which the sense of which read, reorientate the screen so that when course is altered to the specified thing, which was quite a wide alteration, sort of 130 degrees or something, the screen will have been reformed on the new course. And the time for the intended alteration, of course, was so-and-so. And that was absolutely straightforward. And the unfortunate thing was that the particular course he'd selected was such as to absolutely muck up the sonar frequencies of some of my screen. And the only way around this, the weather by this time was not too good, but not too bad either. It was all right. It certainly wasn't blowing gear. And the only way to do this safely was to exchange stations with a pair of ships at a time, which took that much longer, of course, and just you couldn't have a free-for-all, and you had to maintain maximum protection for the last possible minute, and so on. In the course of which, the particular frigate that had this inexperienced captain that I'd been told to watch and help. Got not terribly close, but close enough to an adjacent ship. And they had not been ordered to change station yet. And as the situation developed slightly, and they weren't very close, and I had better radar than the Admiral had, I reckoned anyway. Whether it was better tuned is another matter, but it was the result seemed to be better. And from the flagship's obstrum came a stream of complaints and orders direct to this ship, saying, don't do this and don't do the other, and you're standing into danger, and you're far too close. And it went banging on like this, and there were about half a dozen of these. And after a bit, I thought, oh, no, enough's enough, and I had been briefed by the Admiral. And I got on what was called a plot net, as it were, and it was combat information. And this was, it wasn't supposed to be a chat net, and it certainly wasn't a private net. And I got onto it, and I got onto the flagship's ops room, and said, look, you should know that, and I used the call sign of this ship, the commanding officer so-and-so has problems, and I have been briefed on those problems by the Admiral himself prior to sailing. Now kindly get off his back. And that was that. And shortly after that, we finished reorientating the screen. The alteration, of course, occurred. It all went smoothly. We were all lined up. And I went to bed. I always slept fully clothed. And a couple of hours later or so, I was shaken by my squadron communicator, who was a delightful Australian, but in our Navy, ashen-faced, carrying in his hand a signal, which was, I don't know whether it was secret or not, but it was certainly exclusive. And it started, it was from the Admiral, personal for me. And the first sentence read, I do not like my orders being challenged on an open voice net in the eyes of the entire fleet. And it then banged on about various other things and so forth. And this chap was really very upset, this poor signal officer. I decided that the shaft had got home. Really, it was about time it did. And that was it. I said nothing back. And in due course, we reached Gibraltar. And as soon as we had secured on entry, I thought, well, I better do something about this. And so I made an ICU, request permission to call anew, to the Admiral. Now, we were all very tired by then. We'd been exercising pretty hard, and we were short of sleep and very tired. And the Admiral, bless him, invited me over to supper in the flagship. And we had supper alone together, prior to which he had said, I have now known, I forget the figure he put, 7 or 9 Captain's D since I'd been off home, and only one other would have made a signal like that. And I'm still not quite sure if that was commendation or reproof. and I said, sir, I'm sorry if I have caused offence, but you did brief me. And so far as I was concerned, this had come from a rather itchy staff officer in your ops room, and was in direct contravention of your briefing. And he said, right, we'll say no more about it. He'd been in the ops room himself, of course. Mm. And that was that. We then stumbled through our dinner, barely able to keep our eyes open. And that was my first real getting to know with Admiral Jock Hayes. And we took it from there. It was interesting. The we went on to Malta, and by then I've actually changed command, so to speak, because Doc Hayes et al. Returned to the UK, and I went on into the Mediterranean with a ship or two, and the others were in the Mediterranean, whether already or not, I can't recall. And so it was a different command structure, and I had to get to know different people. My first port of call was Malta, and we went in there, and I found Malta very changed from when I'd last known it, very changed.
In what ways?
Really, in every way. It was pretty edgy in terms of international relationship with the Maltese, Mintoff being the Prime Minister. He had, I think, I may have got the timing wrong, he kicked us out once, and then we went back, having half negotiated a return, but for a limited period, like 3 years, and then he finally kicked us out. And I think that this was our sort of three-year final extension. There were very few ships of our ships in the Navy, very few. We had a full four-star admiral at CNC, John Hamilton. We had a Commodore as Chief of Staff. We had a quite senior captain who I knew well as Captain of the Fleet. There were no cruisers. There was a squadron of coastal minesweepers with a commander as its senior officer. There was my ship, the Galatea. There were a couple of my squadron. And there were one or two others that passed through from time to time. And that was about it. And I found myself heavily involved in NATO exercises with the French, with the Italians, with the Greeks, not much with the Turks, and so on. Which was all great fun, but they were all strangers. And they all had to be treated with a degree of circumspection. And the Frenchman, for example, who was a charming man, and we became great friends, he was actually a rear admiral. And I'll come on to that a bit later. It was quite tricky stuff. And we were, in a word, we were, in a phrase, we were upholding the Raj, as it were. Malta was grossly top-heavy. They had a reduced fleet staff, which were pretty unhelpful. They never came to sea. They never did anything with us. It fell to me to whoever was supposedly in charge pretty well de facto call the tune over the tactical handling of the forces, and so on and so forth. And I think one was able, I hope this doesn't sound boastful, and even the CNC admitted it later on, one was able to raise the standards and set the standards and keep them up of these other foreign, the friendly navies, and so on. Well, we managed to get transferred from a great friend who had left Malta, naval friend. We managed to approach his Maltese landlord and take over his house. And Mary came out, and that was fine. And it was a house in Guatemala, and it was just below where Mary's father had been when he'd been flag officer flotilla's med, which, as I mentioned earlier, when Admiral Dyer came out and didn't initially want a house, had been handed over to the Allied, chief of the Allied staff. And just opposite was Villa Guardamanja, which was another senior NATO house, and so on. So it was a good setup, quite close to a creek where your boat could come in, and so on. And Mary came out with the girls. It was the CNC's practice to arrange affairs as if really he was commanding a full fleet, which he no longer was. And he was, frankly, he was pretty de trop. But he held a senior NATO position, and so forth. And every 6 months, he held a flag and commanding officers meeting, which was quite a normal thing for a commander-in-chief to do, but he did it perhaps rather more frequently than had ever been done out in the Far East, for instance, where the fleet was about 8 times the size. And I'd been tipped off that you got a lot of notice for this, and the agenda was pushed out well in advance. And I was told, I was warned, that a month or so before the meeting actually took place, it would be extended to flag and commanding officers and chaplains meeting. And by this time I had come to realize that the CNC, John Hamilton, very nice man, was, picking my words with slight care, well on the way to becoming, shall I say, over-religious. Not quite a religious maniac, but not all that far short of it. Well, the day came, and the agenda had been promulgated. And present at this meeting was everybody by the kitchen sink that you could dredge up from one place or another in Malta. And the CNC sat at the head of the table, and on his right sat the captain of the fleet, who I knew well, and on his left sat the chief of staff. And on the captain of the fleet's right, I sat. And to the left were the commanding officers, almost entirely lieutenant commanders, apart from the squadron commander, who was a commander of the minesweepers. I don't think my squadron were represented there at all. I think my squadron was out elsewhere. And then we got down to the captain of the shore barracks and the senior surgeon at the naval hospital at Bigi, and the head Wren, who was not very senior. And there must have been a chaplain from somewhere, I'm sure there was, probably from the barracks, I think. And so it went on. And this was really a make-up feed, anything to fill up the table and so forth. And the first item on the agenda was, I think I can remember it almost verbatim, should a divisional officer. Do you know what I mean by that?
No, please explain.
Any ship, whatever size, the sailors, and come to that, the all the sailors, from top to bottom, the communicators, the seamen, the engineers, the technicians, and so forth, are grouped, depending on their subspecialisms, and depending on their numbers, and the normal location in the ship, their action station and so forth, into a so-called division. And each division is allocated an officer who is termed, amongst other things, the divisional officer. And he's responsible, in a nutshell, for the welfare of those men, and for ensuring that their records are kept up to date, that they are given courses for advancement to the next higher rate as and when appropriate, if opportunity offers and that sort of thing. If they misbehave, he appears at the more senior table, the first lieutenant, the executive, even the captain's table if he goes up that far, in their defense, and so forth. But he's responsible for their general welfare, and that sums it up. And the first item on this agenda was, should a divisional officer be responsible for his men's religious welfare? So we had this religious streak coming right out. And they went round the table clockwise. And the unfortunate young coastal minesweeper captains, who were not fools, and they knew the reputation of the boss man, and they knew that it was as much as their life was worth to say nay. And so they fell in line, and they said, well, there can really be no argument about this, because a divisional officer is responsible for every aspect of his men's welfare. And where appropriate, that must, of course, presumably include his religion. And so they rattled on like this, and they all said the same thing. And they got round to the head nurse at Bigi, whose name I can't remember. And she said she thought that was probably right, but she needed to think about it some more. She wasn't absolutely convinced that it was so. And it was quickly moved on to the next person, and so on. And eventually it came to me. And knowing that this was coming, I thought I'd string it along a bit. And so I said, well, the division loss responsibility is very, very straightforward and very comprehensive. And therefore, it can be argued that anything to do with a man's well-being during his time on board ship as part of this officer's division, he must make his responsibility. And it can be argued that, because it is another aspect of his welfare, if you like to use that term, this must include his religious affairs too. And I paused, and I could feel a sort of a smug glow coming from pretty well next door. And I said, but I don't regard it like I would consider it, and so I'm sure would Jack, I would consider it a monstrous intrusion into his privacy. And there was a ghastly pause, and the meeting was closed. We didn't do any other items on the agenda, not that they needed the fishy set of odds. And that was it. And I thought, well, now, you know, I wonder how my relations are with my commander-in-chief. But somebody needed to say something a bit more sensible than that. Because he had nothing else to take passage in, it fell to me to take the commander-in-chief on two visits that he made during my time out there. The first one was to Haifa in the eastern Mediterranean. And this meant a bit of a heave round, because it meant that I had to vacate my cabin and turn it over to the CNC. And I vacated, I occupied the navigating officer's cabin, I think, and he occupied the chart house, or some such. It was a general heave round. And this was all right, because one was at sea, so one was in the ops room or on the bridge most of the time, and so on. And I usually found an excuse to have my meals on my own, except for supper. And supper, I would normally join the commander-in-chief unless the unless passing ships required my presence in the ops room or on the bridge. And that's how it went. And that's fine. And he was a very nice man and easy to talk to and so forth. And we got to Haifa. And the Israelis were very hospitable, and they tended to say, to ask questions like, is this your first visit to Haifa, and so forth. And I had to tell them, harking back to my days in Javelin, that no, I had been one of the filthy Brits patrolling up and down off their coast, preventing them from getting back into their country. At which they would roar with laughter, and we became great friends, and that was fun. And one of the more remarkable visits we made was to Masada. Does that mean anything?
Is that where the Jews held out against the Romans?
Yes. And this is an astonishing feature, overlooking the Dead Sea, with precipitous sides, and one side it was literally precipitous, and the other was approached by what had come to be called the snake path, and it was a sort of flat thing, a plateau on top, and Herod had eventually got the word that he wasn't too popular with all quarters, and he better have a boat hole, and he built a palace on top, and it was quite some palace, and so forth. When the Romans came, they put, I forget how many now, how many armies in to besiege, effectively, Masada. And the snake path was too difficult. It was literally just a single track, and very, very steep, and you couldn't get any equipment up. And the Romans, being the Romans, took their time, and they built a bridge across the precipitous ravine. And their intention, obviously, was eventually to breach the walls with battering rams and so forth. And meantime, the siege had been going on for, I forget how long, 2-3 years sort of thing. And Roman generals had come and Roman generals had gone, and so on. The problem, really, was water. But the Israelis had, the Jews had got round this, and they had a huge sort of cavernous cistern of water, and underground cisterns of corn and stuff, and that was it. But eventually the time arrived when it was generally reckoned that at dawn next day the Romans would assault. They would break down the outer wall, and they would come in and swamp the whole of Masada. And so the head man summoned all the people, and he said, he kept back whatever the number was, a dozen or so, and for the rest he said, better to die with honor than submit to the invading Romans. Go back to your quarters and kill yourselves. Which they did. And the 12 kept back, went the rounds to ensure that everybody had done. And if they found anybody still living, they slit his throat. And then they slit the ram throats. And that was that. And at dawn next day, the Romans did their thing, and they took Masada. And the only reason all this is known is that there was one, I can't remember if it was a boy or a girl, aged not much, sort of 10 or 12 or so, that had hidden, and I think had hidden under dead parents, and escaped to tell the tale. Otherwise, nobody would really have known the extent to which they went. And this was, it was fascinating. We were taken round by a brilliant and very charming archaeologist, and so forth. And then we, the visit ended, and it was a great success, I think. And back we went to Malta. And the next time I had to take the Commander in Chief was on a visit to Venice. And this was, somehow we had now collected the three other ordinary frigates of my squadron, but not the battle class destroyer. And we went as a squadron, and it was a squadron visit, and we anchored off St. Mark's. We moored the boys off St. Mark's. And I, as the flag captain, of course, was tied up with official toings and froings. And Mary came up from Malta, and we were given accommodation ashore. The Italians were brilliant at this, and this was Mussolini, and he had arranged naval, I forget what they called them, but they were effectively officers' clubs in the major ports, of which Venice was one, and very luxurious accommodation. And we had an enormous double room with a bath attached and a separate single room with a single bed in it.
Excuse me.